This is Matt Verboys from La La Land Records, and you've entered the La La Land Lounge on Geekcast Radio.
Hello and welcome to the La La Land Lounge here on the Geekcast Radio Network, the flagship podcast. I'm, of course, TFG and Mike, and it's time for another interview. I talked with MV Gerhard and Matt Verboys earlier this year. We talked about their San Diego Comic-Con adventure and all the superhero Star Trek and wonderful Wonder Woman stuff they had at Comic-Con. But today, we have a returning guest in Neil S. Bulk. Hello, sir.
Hey, good afternoon, or whenever people are listening to this.
Yes, and last time we talked to Neil, we figured out that none of us are too old for this shit, because we were talking about Lethal Weapon at the time. And joining us for the first time here on the Geekcast Radio Network, so we're going to have to get some background information on him, is Dan Goldwasser. Hello, sir.
Hey, good morning, or afternoon, or evening, wherever you may be.
That's enough from the peanut gallery over there.
Thanks, Neil, my number one fan.
Oh, man. You guys worked on the Danny Elfman Batman thing, right?
Yeah.
I can see Neil saying now, Dan, you are my number one guy.
Actually, that was Dan's project, and I sort of got called in at the last minute on Batman, where there was some difficulty finding material.
Mm.
And we've worked together ever since.
Awesome.
Yes. But awesome. Not all.
Yeah, not always, but, you know, collaboration is usually done well when it has like minds in it and whatever else. And between the two of you, you guys have worked on so much stuff, and obviously we're going to focus on what mainly the La La Land Records company has released, because it wouldn't be the La La Land Lounge if I wasn't focusing on what that company released. And just to get some quick background information, Dan, had you always wanted to be in this line of work when you were growing up? Did you think that you were, you know, you enjoyed the music enough that you wanted to do this, or was there another path for you when you were younger?
I kind of fell into film music. I was a big fan of film music as a kid. You know, back in the 80s, there wasn't a way of going to see the movie over and over again. So, you know, you got the novelizations, and as a kid, your parents aren't going to take you to see that movie five times. So you got the novelization and you get the soundtrack, and then you kind of feel like you're reliving the film. When I moved out to LA, though, I came out here for visual effects, ended up falling into film music. I traded soundtrack.net and did that for about 10 years doing film music journalism, and in the process established a lot of connections and contacts out here in the film music industry. And through that, actually MV Gerhard was one of the first people I met when I moved to LA, coincidentally, and then he had a record label, and I started doing some liner notes for them, and that led to doing some producing and art direction. So that's kind of how I fell into that whole pond.
Awesome. And you also, right now, you're running the website Warm Butter Design, where you have all of the soundtracks
So Warm Butter, I mean, that was kind of my own side thing. I was doing freelance web design, when I moved out here, and kind of stuck with that through the various things I've done working out here in L.A., most of my clients are film composers, but through that, again, it also led to doing art direction for albums.
Right.
So I've been doing a lot of artwork, mainly for La La Land, but a few other labels and freelance things as well.
Awesome, awesome. And you guys collaborated and worked on Ferris Bueller's Day Off. We've been waiting 30 years for this, folks.
Yes.
We finally got that batter to swing. So, what was it like working on this, Neil? Like, when you were approached to do the project, what were your excitements about it? What were your trepidations? Did you have a plan right away, or how did that all come about for you?
It goes back a few years, actually, before this project, before I even knew that this project was going to happen. And I didn't realize that Ferris Bueller didn't even have a soundtrack album. And I was at a party in 2008 where, somebody said, "Hey, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I started working on soundtracks." He's like, "Hey, I got a great idea." And this is what usually happens when somebody finds out you work on soundtrack albums. They go, "Hey, I got a great idea for an album that, it's never had a score release and it's great." And usually it's some movie you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, "Oh, that'll sell three copies." And he said, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I was like, wait a minute, what? Ferris Bueller never had a soundtrack album? And he said, no, it didn't. And there's this song in it called Beat City. And it was only available on a 45, and it's never been on CD, and people would want it, and it would be a great album. I went, okay, great, you know, that'll happen, you know, facetiously. And then it turns out, no, La La Land was actually pursuing Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And then when we got the tapes, when they were all transferred, the first thing I looked for was Beat City, that song. And sure, I was like, here it is, we have it. We absolutely have it. And it was just like, this has to be on the album. Like, I don't care what happens, this song has to be on here. And thankfully we were able to get it on there. It was, you know, it was, in terms of, you know, was I happy, sad or anything, it was just like any other project. I was grateful to have the work, and I was going to do the best I could to make sure that it was an enjoyable album.
Right. What about you, Dan? Kind of the same thing. What was your approach to it?
Well, I worked with La La Land to sort of get them in at Paramount back in the late 2010 or 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first projects we had, actually, at the top of our list was Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Beverly Hills Cop. So you look at that, and you know, we kind of hit two holy grails this year, which is really exciting. But it took a few years for Ferris to come around, and the main problem was not so much just, hey, we got to do the project, but it was that the amount of songs that you would have to get cleared and licensed to have a good album was just so daunting and overwhelming that we didn't want to take that on as one of the first Paramount projects. So, you know, work with the studio, make sure they're happy with the work we're doing before you tackle something that is such a high-profile project for them. So around 2013, we actually really started looking at Ferris more seriously. And, you know, again, it's just, you kind of took a kitchen sink approach, wanted to get everything we possibly could on this album. And, you know, over the course of the next few years, I mean, it took about another year and a half to figure everything out and get it really going to the point where we were transferring material. Even then, the licensing kind of beast kept rearing its head as not a roadblock, but a hurdle. To get around. And as I'm sure you have the final album, in the end, you know, there are a few songs we could not get the licensing for, which, you know, is always on a personal level a bummer, because you want to make this the best album you possibly can. But at the same time, I mean, you know, as Neil pointed out, as long as we had the stuff you couldn't get, like Beat City, you know, I'm Afraid, or even the, you know, the score and things like that. You know, the other songs we couldn't get, you know, you can get on iTunes. They're available. So it wasn't going to be, you know, such a tragedy of epic proportions. It's disappointing, but still, this is one of those projects that, I mean, it's such a dream come true to have anything out from Ferris Bueller's Day Off that I'm happy with what we have.
Yeah. When I first got the disc and I put it in and I added it to my iTunes and all that stuff, at first, I just made one playlist of the whole thing, and then after one listen through, I said, okay, well, I love the songs. I love the actual songs, and that's all great, because my number one thing was, and I'm sure it's out there somewhere, I'm sure Yellow has, you know, an album version of it somewhere, but I wanted it, Oh Yeah, on the Ferris soundtrack, and it is. But for me, after listening through the whole thing once, I'm like, okay, I need to separate this. I need to have one that's just the songs and one that's just the score. Because as Neil will tell you, I am one of those people, and I think I'm a very rare person that can do this. I can turn on a score, any score, it doesn't matter, as long as I enjoy where it comes from. Turn it up as loud as I possibly, basically blow my ears out, basically make my headphones explode, close my eyes, and just enjoy the music. And just immerse myself into that. And I can remember and think of various parts of, you know, parts of the film from, like, you know, you got on the Ferris score, just as an example, you got Cameron in bed and Ferris goes Hawaiian. Well, we all know what that is from. That is from the very beginning of the movie when we meet Cameron and he's in bed and Ferris calls him and says, get over here. You're my best friend. You know, and all that. So we, you know, I can envision that scene in my brain as I'm listening to it. And yeah, there are a few songs here missing, like the one with the English beat and all that, but as you said, you know, you can still get them elsewhere. Would it have been great if that English Beat song would be on here? Yeah, sure, absolutely, because everybody remembers that, because that's obviously at the point in the movie when Ferris runs home. But no, I mean, I'm so happy this came out this year, because this is the 30th anniversary of the movie.
Right. Well, that was one of those sort of lucky accidents. You know, we wanted to get this out earlier, around 2013 or even 14. But just the timing and the way things were working with the clearances, it just ended up being one of those situations where fortuitously our release date ended up coinciding with the 30th anniversary. So we made a concerned effort to get it out this year.
Mm-hmm. All right. So before we move away from La La Land's day off here, I'm going to ask each of you, Neil, do you have a favorite score track and a favorite song that's on the Ferris release?
Okay, I think my favorite song is "I'm Afraid."
Okay,
with the lyrics, it was fun to work on that one. There were some challenges with the audio, and it was really nice to get it in releasable shape and get it remixed, and really listening to the lyrics of that one, you go, "Oh my gosh, this song's really about Cameron." Mm-hmm. And in the film, there are no lyrics. It plays as score in the film. That's why we have two versions of that song on there. But I really enjoyed it with the lyrics. Favorite score cue, when I first started cutting the score, I don't even think I was cutting the score at that point. I think I was just looking at the tapes in mm-hmm. Pro Tools going, I found the moment Ferris Bueller's on line two.
Yep.
Rooney, you know, thinks he's talking to Ferris Bueller, but it's a whole, you know the scene with the telephone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's this great horror sting that, you know, as soon as you hear it, you know it's Ferris Bueller. And so, sorry, Dan, I think I'm going to pick that one.
No, that's fine. We picked these earlier.
Yeah.
Neil, really quick, before I let Dan go and pick his choices off of Ferris, talk to us. You know, you said about that there were complications with I'm Afraid. What were some of those complications?
It was very strange. The audio or the lyrics didn't line up with... I had it as two three-track elements. I had a three-track band, which allowed us to do the instrumental version,
mm-hmm.
and I had three-track vocals, which were the lead vocal on one of the channels and chorus on the other two channels, and they weren't lining up.
Oh, wow.
At all. There was complete, it was like there was nothing lining up. So I was really freaking out about this, and then one of the things we had for reference on this project was the John Hughes-produced 7-inch single, which one side was Beat City, the other side was I'm Afraid. So I said, okay, I've already transferred this in. Let me line up the music to this 45, and then I'll line up the vocals to the 45, and it should all come out perfectly. And it did. But it required, you know, a lot of paying attention, sitting down and chopping up little sections and sliding things and getting it all in shape. And it's seamless. You can't tell. So I'm very proud of that.
Absolutely. All right, Dan, what about you? Your favorite song off of Ferris and then favorite score cue.
Well, my favorite song is the instrumental of the Dream Academy, Please, Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want. And I don't know, it's just one of those songs. When I first saw the film as a kid, you know, it really, I thought it was score cue, you know, part of the score, because there's, again, no lyrics. But it's just really one of those evocative sort of moving scenes. You know, they're in the museum and Cameron's staring at the Sunday afternoon painting. And it just really was an emotionally kind of like edged piece of music that I really just loved. And in terms of score, it's got to be Rooney on Patrol, which is kind of the big band, you know, swinging music that Ira Newborn did, very much in style of his, you know, Police Squad and Naked Gun music.
Also, records produced by Dan Goldwasser of Neil S. Paul.
Yes, that's right. Yes,
that's right.
got to get the plug in. We have a nice 3-disc box set of music from all 3 Naked Gun films available. So
yeah, that was. I think that was one of the other things that Neil and I had talked about a couple of years ago. We talked about Lethal Weapon and we talked about Naked Gun. I think at the time, I think Naked Gun was out in 2014, wasn't it? Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. I think so. I don't remember.
So I'll take your word for that.
Yeah. For me, it's got to be Oh Yeah, and it's got to be the source cue for Ballpark Baloney, because I just love the Hey Batter. I just love the Hey Batter scene. I just love that. Let's go to Detroit and then fly to Beverly Hills, because I remember when Matt and MV had said, when I interviewed them, they had been teasing something about a certain Maverick, and I'm like, please let it happen, please let it happen, another 30th anniversary movie, if that, you know, if they got, you know, Top Gun. And nothing yet. They've kind of said maybe it could happen, and they've teased it like heck everywhere. But I had also said to them something about, and I didn't even know that this was happening, something about Beverly Hills Cop, and they're like, oh, just wait until December, you're going to like it. I'm like, okay, fine. And then, hey, look, Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2.
There you go.
So... Yeah, ain't that the truth. So Neil, working on this one, were there any complications, or was this fairly easy to come by? Because you guys have pretty much the full score, as well as certain selections of the songs from Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2. Talk about Beverly Hills Cop 1 first.
Well, I'll talk about them together, because I did them right back to back, and there was very little difference between them on my end.
Mm-hmm.
On this one, it was a matter of, we had the digital multi-track tapes transferred, and they had 4-track mixes on them that we needed mixed down to stereo. So that was really my job on this one, was just to take the raw cues and make them presentable to Dan, you know, something he could use to shape the album, because he was producing it. Mm-hmm. The big challenge was, and this was a surprise, because again, it's digital, there shouldn't be this problem, but as I was mixing Beverly Hills Cop 2, which I did first, I had I was listening to this opening track, like, wow, there's a lot of hiss on the right channel.
Okay.
Well, that's weird. It's digital. Why is there hiss? And it was present throughout the whole thing. So that needed, you know, cleaning up, and I just paid particular attention to that and made sure that didn't come through to the album, that it was cleaned up. Otherwise, I don't really recall too many challenges on this one. It was just, I really enjoy both movies. I've always enjoyed Beverly Hills Cop 2. I think it's a very stylish film. It's a very influential film in terms of action filmmaking. If you watch the first one is not too far removed from sort of a 70s era pulp crime film. It obviously has Harold Faltermeyer's score, which elevates it and brings it into the 80s. But if you watch the film, it's very gritty and dark. And the second one is a complete departure from that. The second one, I think, is a huge influence on directors today, like Michael Bay, where, you know, you've got these orange, you know, sun, you know, views of the sky,
mm-hmm.
and it's very glossy and slick looking. So I've always been, you know, I've always enjoyed part two. I've always appreciated it. So I don't know if I answered the question, but there you go.
Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, if I could interject here about the change in tone between the first and second films. The second one also, I mean, you have to keep in mind, it was not only, these were both Bruckheimer, you know, and you know, Simpson Productions, but they were also, it was Tony Scott directing the second one. And he's like, you know, before Michael Bay, I mean, he was the king of the filters and even and the crazy editing and really kind of pushing the bounds of what cinema could do with action. And I think Bay came from that school through his midi, you know, music videos and the other influences he's had, certainly working with Jerry Bruckheimer as well. So I think it's more, it's a question of like, is it the chicken or the egg? Is it the Bruckheimer connection or is it the, you know, Tony Scott connection? But I think the combination of the two of them is really why that film feels so different from the first one.
Right. And I even remember when the first, when the second one came out, people were complaining about how loud it was. that it was such a loud movie, and you look at it and you go, you know, I could see that, you know, that opening scene is pretty noisy.
I think the only other noisiest opening scene movie I've seen in my lifetime is The Dark Knight. The very beginning of The Dark Knight, when they're flying through the city and they're, you know, because they're just showing you the Joker's on the roof and all that. The beginning, I have to turn my volume on my computer almost all the way down because the music from Zimmer in that beginning part of the scene is so loud. with Beverly Hills Cop 2, I originally, and I was 7 when it came out, I was probably 8 or 9 when I saw it. My mom, and I've said this on other podcasts a billion times, my mom pretty much let me watch anything I wanted to watch. It didn't matter what the rating was, as, you know, as long as it was on VHS. And I always remember seeing Cop 2 before Cop... It wasn't for a few years that I'd saw Cop 1. I only knew of Cop 2. And the whole... I'm undercover deep now, but I now have to go deep, deep, deep under... Oh, God, just... and the difference is, you're right. You know, the first one is kind of dark and gritty. It has some humor, but there... By the second movie, we're to understand that Axel... Rosewood and Taggart and Captain Bogomil have all known each other for a few years now. In the very beginning, in the first one, they were all just meeting for the first time, so that's kind of that awkward phase of their styles mixing with Axel's style, and by the second one, it just kind of all meshes together. And I mean, you know, then you got Lutz and Bibble. Lutz and Biddle, it's like Kibbles and Bits.
Kibbles and Bits, yeah. There was some strangeness, though, in part two. And again, I like part two.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't it strange that Axel Foley is portrayed as this street smart cop, and then there's a conversation where he says he's going to teach people how to fish? Wait a minute. What does a guy from the city know about fishing?
Yeah, you know.
I'm not sure.
But I like part two.
And I think this is the only movie of the 80s, and I could be wrong, I'd have to actually look at this, but I think this is the only action movie of the 80s that actually featured Hugh Hefner in the Playboy Mansion.
Hey, that's a good call.
All right, Dan, talk to me about the album production side of this, as far as getting the score together, the Faltermeyer score, plus adding in the songs to both of them, because I looked at this, I was like... When I first saw the announcement, I'm like, okay, as long as the majority of the score is there, as long as the Axel F theme is there, I'm fine. And then I saw, ooh, they're adding the songs. And for me, I've had a ripped copy of Shakedown for the longest time. I don't think that's on any of Seeger's other albums. I've never seen it on any of his other albums. And I saw that on Beverly Hills Cop 2. I'm like, yes, finally, a legitimate copy.
Well, I'd have to double check on Shakedown. I mean, that... Wasn't that on the original soundtrack?
It was on the original album, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Is that out of print? Maybe it's out of print.
I think that's what it is,
yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
So, no, it's one of those, again, this, you know, Beverly Hills Cop was at the top of our list of projects we wanted to do when we kind of met up with Paramount. And the limitations of this is that it's a co-license situation because there was a soundtrack that had been released previously, as we all know. So that was MCA Records at the time for both Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2, which means Universal Music would have to be involved. And so there were a few limitations in terms of getting this project going. We didn't want to, again, like Ferris, we didn't want to kind of hit the ground running at Paramount with the hardest projects to clear. But even though we could get Universal Music on board, having done other co-productions with them, the bigger problem was that there was a Beverly Hills Cop TV show in the works. So Paramount had flagged Beverly Hills Cop as a property that really no one could touch right now. You know what? Just not right now. We got a new thing coming out with it, so we'll have to wait. And as you may or may not know, they did shoot a pilot for a Beverly Hills Cop TV show. I think it focused on Axel Foley's son. Eddie Murphy was in it. It was for CBS, and they passed on it, and it went away. So, great. So we're going to be able to do Beverly Hills Cop now. No, actually, they're going to do Beverly Hills Cop 4, and Brett Ratner is going to direct it. Oh, okay. So now a few years go by. It actually got to the point where, because we had done Days of Thunder, the Tom Cruise movie, which, again, Tony Scott and Jerry Bruckheimer, and Bruckheimer was involved with that project. We worked with him on it, and we had a connection over at Bruckheimer, and it was through him, it was personally approved by Jerry Bruckheimer that, you know what, let them do Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2. Because if anyone's going to be working on any future Beverly Hills Cop sequels, and now I hear it's happening with two other directors, and who knows where it's at least, you know, why should we have to keep waiting?
Right.
So thankfully, once we got the green light from Jerry, that was it. There were no more limitations. We had Paramount on board, we had Universal Music on board, and we just hit the ground running. And as Neil said, the transfers were pretty straightforward. Once we had the material, it was just a question of the songs. And for the majority of the project, we built it as a two-disc set, which is going to be the, you know, Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And we then discovered, you know, these things just happen with the licensing limitations that Universal Music was requiring that they be individual albums. So, okay, so we'll do a Beverly Hills Cop album, we'll do a Beverly Hills Cop 2 album. No problem. Then there became the question of what songs do we put on there? And I'd always taken the approach of, let's only put the songs on our album that are in the film. Because, you know, as we all know, back in the 80s, there was this sort of trend of putting music from and inspired by the movie.
Yeah.
And Beverly Hills Cop, the original song album, I mean, there's like 5 or 6 songs on there that just aren't in the film at all.
Mm-hmm.
So why would we license them for our album? So, you know, kind of went with that approach. But then there became the question on Universal Music's end, hey, maybe we have to include all the songs, which means we would have to have 2-disc versions of each film because it wouldn't all fit on one disc.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily, it all worked out. We only had to put the songs on that were in the film, which were the ones we wanted. There were still some songs we would have loved to have but couldn't get. You know, these are the limitations of licensing. You know, the versions of some songs. Like, we can only put the version that was on the original album. So we're not going to, you know, film version of something versus an album version of something. It's like, you know, again, the dream project would be a 6-disc set of everything. but what are you going to do? Once all that had been kind of worked out and we had our album assembly, and Doug Schwartz did an excellent job mastering it, I gotta say, I think it sounds excellent. You know, it just kind of all came together pretty quickly, and that was that, I guess. You know, I will say, in Beverly Hills Cop 1, and maybe this was just the thing that was going on in the early 80s, in the film itself, you'll notice this, a cue will just stop. There's no fade out, there's no elegant end to it, it just stops. Well, the thing is, that's how the cue was. It's not like the music editor just kind of cut it there. The cue actually just cuts right there. It just stops. So there were a few instances where we had to create a more sort of elegant, you know, ending to the album with a fade or a little ring out or something to make it, you know, feel like you didn't have a broken CD.
Right.
But, you know, and that was pretty much it. There was, I can't remember the exact track offhand because I don't have it, but there was one sting, kind of like a little overlay swell, that just we didn't have, but it's in the film, and we had access to the mono music stem, so I was able to sort of sneak that in at the head of one track, just so it felt like this is how it was in the film, so you didn't get that weird abrupt entrance as well.
Right, absolutely. All right, so Dan, what is your favorite cue from 1 and 2, and what is your favorite song from 1 and 2?
Well, see, this is where it's like, you know, the old Chevy Chase. I was informed there would be no math. I didn't even realize we were going to talk about Beverly Hills Cop, so I don't have an answer prepared. If I had to make up an answer on the fly, I'm just going to go with The Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
as a score cue from Beverly Hills Cop. Favorite song, of course, is going to be The Heat Is On. For Beverly Hills Cop 2, I'd have to say it's going to be Shootout. Song, it's actually going to be Bad Guys, which was one of those songs that you couldn't get because it was only available on Harold's sort of solo album, but it was the main theme from the film, and he did a song of it, and no, it was never on the album, so I'm glad we have that on this one.
Neil, go with one first, then you can get to two.
You know what? I don't even remember. This wasn't my project, so I don't even remember so much about it. I'm going to go with Neutron Dance.
Okay.
I've always liked that song. Again, I love the opening of the movie, so the Adrianus opening cue is great. The Axel F theme from part one. And for song, I Shakedown, because it's a great main. It's a great opening title sequence. Shakedown, breakdown, takedown. Everybody wants into the
crowd alive. Breakdown, takedown. The buster. Yeah, Beverly Hills Cop 2 has the best opening and closing songs. It's got Shakedown in the beginning, and it's got Better Way from Ingram at the end.
Yeah, that is a great song.
Because by the end of the movie, when they say, Axel, is that really your uncle's house? Of course it is. Trust me. You know, and he has that classic Axel F. Eddie Murphy smirk, and he drives off in his little convertible. And I never expected, nor did I ever really want a third movie, but it's there.
Right.
It's there. I
will fully admit without any embarrassment that I have never seen it.
Really?
Yeah, I've never seen Beverly Hills Cop 3. And I'm a John Landis fan, too. I mean, he's a cool guy. So it's like, it's on my list of things to see eventually. I just haven't felt compelled.
I saw it opening day.
Of course you did.
That's the thing is, no one has given me a good reason to rush out and see it. I mean, I will see it. I watch a lot of bad films, so you know.
Well, you can't say it's bad because you haven't seen it yet.
I know, but I'm just given what other people have said.
I'll tell you, there's a moment in that movie. I saw it in 1994 when it opened, and mm-hmm. the theater I saw it at had recently opened, and it was the first THX theater that I'd ever been to, and it was 20 minutes from my house. So that I mean, it was like, well, that's the theater I'm going to from now on. It's THX certified. Then they lost the certification at the end of the year. But but I went to see Beverly Hills Cop there, opening Beverly Hills Cop 3, their opening day in their THX certified theater in DTS sound. And there was a scene in that movie that has scared me more than any other film has purely from sound design. It involves a moment where Axel Foley's on a payphone, and yeah. someone takes a shot at him, and the shot came from the left surround channel.
Oh, gee, yeah.
Like, oh my god! One shot in the theater.
There was
in 1994.
There was a one surround sound moment in Urban Legend. You remember that horror film? Mm-hmm. It was just a glass breaking that they hear off, and they kind of all turn and look. But it was like it was one of those perfectly placed moments. And it's just in the left rear or something like that, and it just, you thought someone dropped something in the theater.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what really freaked me. It was like, oh my gosh, I'm like getting shot in the movies.
Well,
yeah. Beverly Hills Cop 3. I don't want to spoil it for you, Dan, but it's got some interesting moments. I will say, I don't think this is a spoiler because I'm sure if people look it up, they'll know this at this point. So in the first movie, we had Bronson Pinchot as Serge, and he returns in the third movie. He wasn't in the second one. And it's interesting how he returns, because, yeah, that was... I don't even know how to describe that.
That's not a spoiler. It was in the trailer.
Oh, well. That's one. Well, yeah, he said he never saw it, so I assume he never saw the trailer either.
I know an awful lot about Beverly Hills.
Well, now I know what I'm going to be watching this weekend.
You know, I remember a few years ago when I first got Netflix streaming,
mm-hmm.
and it was always funny. It was like, well, they don't have Chinatown, but they have the two Jakes. Huh. And it's like, well, they don't have Beverly Hills Cop 1 or 2, but they have Beverly Hills Cop 3. It's like, well, yeah. Guess I'll watch that. So I actually did watch it a few years ago again.
I will definitely be checking it out. I know, and MV has mentioned this as well. It's something that, you know, it's on our list of things to consider looking into. It's not, you know, at the top of the list right now, but, you know, certainly it would be a nice thing, I think, personally, eventually, to have kind of, you know, wrapped up the trilogy, as they say.
Yeah. And did that even have an album? Do we know?
Don't think so.
I believe... The answer to that is a resounding no.
Okay. So...
Oh, wait. No. I apologize. The answer to that is resounding yes, of course. It was Nile Rodgers. So
okay.
he did indeed have a song album which featured a Patti LaBelle track and, you know, Tony Tone, the Supremes. So it's kind of, you know, it was an MCA Records thing. It's something that there's no score on except for his version of Axel F that Nile Rodgers assembled.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I haven't seen the film yet, so I'm admitting it fully and freely. Once I see the film, I'll see.
This is not a spoiler, but you just mentioned the Supremes are on there. There's actually a very funny scene in the beginning with the Supremes, involving okay. the Supremes. So.
Well, then there you go.
And as a John Landis film, lots of famous directors show up in it.
Good. Well, I'm just more curious where the See You Next Wednesday reference is going to be.
You know, I don't remember where it is in that, but I'm sure it's there.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Do you know about that, Mike? Do you know about See You Next Wednesday?
Not off the top of my head, no.
But let's leave it there. Mike, explore John Landis and See You Next Wednesday.
Okay. And 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
Oh, that's... See, yeah. There are certain things that my mom allowed me to watch, and there are certain things I just avoided as a kid, and I've never actually... I know of the HAL 9000, but I've never actually seen the whole movie. That's probably something I should do at this point. With Beverly Hills Cop 3, just make sure you don't get trapped into doing the okie dokie shuffle. That's all I'm going to say, Dan.
Hey, so okay. Talking about Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Yes.
To talk about the Ferris Bueller television series?
Please, no.
Oh, okay. I just figured we were gonna.
It was Parker Lewis Can't Lose destroyed it. I think is
Parker Lewis Can't Lose was a very good show.
Yeah, and it destroyed the Ferris Bueller's Day Off series because it was
Mike,
a better version of it.
Mike, do you know about this?
Yeah, I think I know. You can go ahead and tell the story, but I think I remember hearing about it.
In 1990, two shows debuted on two different networks. NBC had Ferris Bueller's, I think it was just called Ferris Bueller, and Fox had Parker Lewis Can't Lose. Completely different shows, but they were very similar, and they involved, you know, high school kids getting away with stuff, basically.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the one that was based on Ferris Bueller's Day Off was not as successful as the one that was, you know, completely independent of that franchise.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing. Like, there are certain movies that can spawn off TV series, animated, short-lived animated series, like Star Trek and things like that, even though Star Trek animated series is god-awful at best.
I disagree. It has limitations.
Yeah.
But it also has it has some good moments to it.
And for me, it's one of those things where I was fine with Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2. I did not necessarily need 3, and I'm still of the strong opinion that 1994, between 94 and 87, that was too long. Back then, movies were releasing one every two and a half years. Waiting more than 2.5 years, and you know, in that time, it just seemed like it's too long. Like, what was it? We just had a move. Oh yeah, Independence.
I said Blues Brothers 2000.
Yes, there's that, and then there's Independence Day. Waited 20 years to make that sequel. So no resurgence for you, Will Ferrell. Wow, not Will Ferrell, Will Smith. There you go. With Beverly Hills Cop. Huh?
I saw Will Smith lucked out.
Yeah.
He wasn't in it.
Yep. I I've heard the rumors of Beverly Hills Cop 4 in the TV series, and I really think the movie's franchise, well, Beverly Hills Cop 3 is more of a full-on comedy slash action. Like, I would not bill it as an action comedy. I would bill it as a comedy action movie because it's more comedy than, I mean, there is action in it, but it's not really taking the series as serious as it was. You look at 2 and 3, 2 is comedy and action together. 3 is more of, hey, let's go for the below the belt stuff. Like, there's just too much comedy for me in 3. Hmm. I don't know. What do you guys got coming up, Neil? Anything you can reveal that won't get you in trouble?
Well, Dan and I we're working on the Wonder Woman soundtrack album for La La Land Records. I produced it, and Dan did the artwork for it, and that's coming along very nicely, actually. It was supposed to be out right now, actually, so we're way ahead of schedule on it. But the Warner Brothers has a big new Wonder Woman movie coming out next year.
So they're going to tie it into that release?
They would like to have some, you know, a marketing campaign where we're going to be, you know, they're going to release all this great Wonder Woman stuff. And look, here's also a soundtrack album. So hopefully that'll happen. So we're hoping it'll be out sometime next year, you know, spring, summer, hopefully.
So you guys are working on the TV show soundtrack. Are you also going to be working on the movie soundtrack, or is that something completely?
No,
okay.
That'll be independent of us. We're working on the Linda Carter television series.
Yeah, I think Water Tower Records is probably just going to put that out themselves.
Right.
The new one, that is. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah, and me, I actually, independently, I've been producing the digital single releases of songs from Family Guy. So if you're a fan of those crazy songs from Family Guy, 8 of them are hitting iTunes over, you know, every 2 weeks we're releasing one. And I think we're at number 6 or 7 this week. So by the time you hear this, it's probably already out. But the Emmy-nominated song Down's Syndrome Girl is going to hit iTunes and other digital retailers. So that's a project I've been working on for about 8 years or so, is stuff from Family Guy.
That's awesome. Was that on the La La Land release, or is that
so
completely?
No, okay. It's separate. La La Land's album was just the score.
And
because of limitations on that one was just the score from the first 3.5 seasons of the show.
Oh, wow.
Originally, I had a 2-disc set of music from, you know, select episodes from the first 12 years of the show. And we unfortunately hit a roadblock there. But at least, you know, that one came out on La La Land. But the songs were always kind of a separate thing. That's just me working with Fox doing that. It's kind of been a long journey. Ever since I asked Seth MacFarlane back in 2008, hey, how come there's no songs from Family Guy, like, released? Well, I know the answer. So it's been a very long journey, but at least there's stuff coming out digitally now. Hopefully some fans will enjoy that.
So Dan, is it going to be 8 songs total, or are you going to keep doing it?
Well, this first batch is 8 songs, mm-hmm. and depending on how well they do, hopefully then Fox will see reason to do more, and that's my hope and dream. So I'm trying to let people know about them as best I can. I'm like a one-man promotional machine, which is not to say much at all, but I do have the Fox, the Family Guy Facebook and Twitter do announce the releases as they hit every other week, so that helps a bit, and hopefully the fans will discover them. And, you know, it's kind of like a slow burn thing, but hopefully it'll all make its money back to the point where Fox says, hey, let's do more, because there's a lot of great songs that we have not released that people do want. So
yeah, I mean, you guys could do, you know, you said the La La Land copy was from the first 3 seasons. I mean, they could technically do the next three.
Yeah, they technically could. The limitations were on the union side of things. So there's a sort of a time lock. Leave it at that. There are restrictions in place that we are not there are restrictions in place that are outside our control. And so we'll have to sort of take a wait and see attitude to that one.
Yeah.
For the score, at least.
Yeah, for the score, at least. So yeah, we've got a bunch of cool stuff coming up here, folks. I've got on La La Lounge. Let's see, the next episode after this interview. The last episode you guys heard was I find that when they send me stuff, that I like to combine them, because the La La Land, if anyone's listened to the La La Land Lounge, hopefully you are, they're short podcasts because they're short album reviews. Like, I don't spend a half an hour talking about a 1-disc release. I spend about between 8 and 12 minutes on each one. So I've been combining ones. So the last episode we had was episode 5, where I took Primal Fear and Ferris Bueller and titled the episode The Primal Fear of Ferris Bueller.
Oh, nice.
So, coming up after this interview, we're going to be doing the Beverly Hills Cop 30th anniversary release for the second, because next year is the 30th anniversary of the second film.
Yep.
So, we'll do that. And then we've got Legends Season 1 and Arrow Season 4 coming, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And hopefully I'll have Dan and Neil on here again soon to talk about any new projects they're working on. Dan, do you want to give your social media stuff out, like Twitter or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, that made me laugh.
They can actually, what I will say is, you know, I also, aside from the web design and the album stuff, I do scoringsessions.com. So it's the only real website on the internet that focuses on film music scoring sessions. Mm-hmm. Galleries and, you know, that's about it. Galleries and news items of those galleries. So, for instance, I just put up my Moana scoring session coverage. So, you know, that's sort of, they can check me out there at scoringsessions.com.
What about you, Neil? You got a website or anything you want to give out to people?
You can follow me on Twitter. It's at NSBulk. Those are my first two initials and my last name, NSBulk. And I generally tweet about geeky stuff, but in light of current events, I've been been tweeting a bit too much, probably. It may not have been quite as entertaining as it used to be. I apologize, but
be careful. The new president might take your Twitter account away.
You know, I haven't burned a flag yet, so. Did we just get political? I'm so sorry.
On that note, we need to make this podcast go in a better way. So we're going to get the heck out of here, folks. You can find me on Twitter at TFG1Mike. Also follow at GeekCast Radio for all of the network updates. I want to thank Neil and Dan, I'll ask you guys to hold the line. And like I said, folks, next time on La La Land Lounge, we're going to be celebrating Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2 with a review of those scores. So head on over to lalalandrecords.com where soundtracks live, and we will catch you next time.